Good morning, Auroville. This is Abhijit with you again. And I'm broadcasting from Auroville Radio. And I'm back with my series on exploring education in arts, animation, and filmmaking. Today, I'm covering another topic in filmmaking. And I've been talking about post-World War I cinema. And in my last episode on filmmaking, I talked about American cinema. Today, I'm going to start talking about European cinema. And I would like to apologize as I'm going to be covering the German cinema. And there are a lot of names that I'm probably going to be butchering when it comes to names of people. And I will stick to, I tried to learn the names of the movies, but it's very difficult on my tongue. So I will name the movies in English. I hope you don't mind. So with that, I'll just start today's episode. And today we are covering post-World War I European cinema. Prior to World War I, the American cinema had lagged behind the film industries of Europe, particularly those of France and Italy. In such matters as feature production and the establishment of permanent theaters. During the war, however, European film production virtually ceased, in part because of the same chemicals used in the production of celluloid were necessary for the manufacture of gunpowder. The American cinema, meanwhile, experienced a period of unprecedented prosperity and growth. By the end of the war, it exercised nearly total control of the international market. When the Treaty of Versailles was signed in 1919, 90% of all films screened in Europe, Africa, and Asia were American. And the figure of South America was and remained through the 1950s close to 100%. The main exception was Germany, which had been cut off from American films from 1914 until the end of the war. So we are in Germany now. Before World War I, the German motion picture audience drew broadly from different social classes, and the country was among the leaders in the construction of film theaters. But German film production lagged behind that of several other European countries, and Denmark's film industry in particular played a more prominent role in German film exhibition than did many domestic companies. This dependence on imported films became a matter of concern among the military leaders during the war. When a flood of effective anti-German propaganda films began to pour into Germany from the Allied countries. Therefore, on December 18, 1917, the German general Heinrich Ludendorff ordered the merger of the main German production, distribution and exhibition companies into the government-subsidized conglomerate Universum Film Aktiengesellschaft, or UFA. UFA's mission was to upgrade the quality of German films. The organization proved to be highly effective, and when the war ended in Germany's defeat in November 1918, the German film industry was prepared for the first time to compete in the international marketplace. Transferred to private control, UFA became the single largest studio in Europe and produced most of the films associated with the golden age of German cinema during the Weimar Republic that lasted from 1919 till 1933. UFA's first peacetime productions were elaborate costume dramas, also known as costume film, in the vein of the pre-war Italian super spectacles. And the master of this form was Heinrich Lubitsch, who directed such lavish and successful historical pageants as, and I will name the English names for the movies, released in the United States as Passion in 1919, Deception in 1920, and The Loves of Pharaoh in 1921, before immigrating to the United States in 1922. These films earned the German cinema a foothold in the world market, but it was an expressionist work, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, in 1919 that brought the industry its first great artistic acclaim. Based on the scenario by the Czech poet Hans Janowitz and the Austrian writer Karl Mayer, the film recounts a series of brutal murders that were committed in the North German town of Holstenwald by somnambulists at the bidding of a demented mountebank. who believes himself to be the incarnation of the homicidal 18th century hypnotist named Dr. Calgary. Enric Pomar, Calgary's producer at an independent production company that was to merge with UFA in 1921, added a scene to the original scenario so that the story appears to be narrated by a madman confined to an asylum of which the mountebank is directed and head psychiatrist. To represent the narrator's tortured mental state, the director, Robert Wine, hired three prominent expressionist artists, Herman Wahm, Walter Rohnik, and Walter Ryman, to design sets that depicted exaggerated dimensions and deformed spatial relationships. To heighten the architectural stylization and also to economize on electric power, which was rationed in post-war Germany, bizarre patterns of light and shadows were painted directly onto the scenario and even into the character's makeup. In its effort to embody disturbed psychological states through the decor, Calgary influenced enormously the UFF films that followed it and gave rise to the movement known as German Expressionism. The films of this movement were completely studio-made and often used distorted sets and lighting effects to create a highly subjective mood. They were primarily films of fantasy and terror that employed horrific plots to express the theme of the soul in search of itself. Most were photographed by one of the two great cinematographers of the Weimar period, Karl Freund and Fritz Arno Wagner. Representative work included F.W. Murnau's Janus Faced in 1920, adapted from Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Paul Wegener and Karl Bosse, The Golem, in 1920, adapted from a Jewish legend in which a gigantic clay statue became a raging monster, Arthur Robinson's Shatten, or Warning Shadows, in 1922, and Wayne's Raskolnikov in 1923. Based on Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, Paul Lenny's Waxworks in 1924, and Henrik Galland's The Student of Prague in 1926, which combines the Faust legend with a doppelganger or double motif. In addition to winning international prestige for German films, Expressionism produced two directors who would become major figures in world cinema, Fritz Lang and F.W. Murnau. Lang had already directed several successful serials, including The Spiders from 1919 to 1920, when he collaborated with his future wife and scriptwriter Thea von Harbau to produce Destiny in 1921 for Decla Bioscope. This episodic romantic allegory of doomed lovers, set in several different historic periods, earned Lang acclaim for his dynamic compositions of architectural line and space. Lang's use of striking, stylized images is also demonstrated in the other films of his expressionist period, notably the crime melodrama Dr. Mabuse, The Gambler, in 1922, the Wagnerian diptych Siegfried from 1922-24, and Kriemhild's Revenge from 1922-1923, and the stunningly futuristic Metropolis in 1926. Perhaps the greatest science fiction film ever made. After directing the early sound masterpiece M in 1931, based on child murders in Düsseldorf, Lang became increasingly estranged from German political life. He emigrated in 1933 to escape the Nazis and began a second career in the Hollywood studios the following year. Murnau made several minor expressionist films before directing one of the movement's classics, an unauthorized adaptation of Bram Stoker's novel Dracula, entitled Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, in 1922, but it was The Last Laugh in 1924, a film in the genre of Kammerspiel, or intimate theater, that made him world famous. Scripted by Karl Mayer and produced by Erich Pommer of UFA, Letz Mann told the story of a hotel doorman who is humiliated by the loss of his job and, more important, apparently in post-war German society, of his splendid paramilitary uniform. Murnau and Karl Freund his cameramen gave this simple tale a complex narrative structure through their innovative use of camera movement and subjective point of view shots. In one famous example, Freund strapped a lightweight camera to his chest and stumbled drunkenly around the set of a bedroom to record the inebriate porter's point of view. In the absence of modern cranes and dollies at various points in the filming, Murnau and Freund placed the camera on moving bicycles, fire engine ladders, and overhead cables in order to achieve smooth, sustained movement. The total effect was a tapestry of subjectively involving movement and intense identification with the narrative. Even more remarkably, the film conveyed its meaning without using any printed intertalies for dialogue and explanation. Der Lensmann was universally hailed as a masterpiece and probably had more influence on Hollywood style than any other single foreign film in history. Its unchained camera technique, Meyer's phrase, spawned many imitations in Germany and elsewhere, the most significant being E.A. DuPont's circus tent melodrama Verite in 1925. The film also brought Murnau a long-term Hollywood contract, which he began to fulfill in 1927 after completing two last super productions, Tartuffe in 1925 and Faust in 1926 for UFA. In 1924, the German Mark was established by the so-called Davis Plan, which financed the long-term payment of Germany's war reparations debt and curtailed all exports. This created an artificial prosperity in the economy at large, which lasted only until the stock market crash in 1929. But it was devastating to the film industry, the bulk of whose revenues came from foreign markets. Hollywood then seized the opportunity to cripple its only serious European rival, saturating Germany with American films and buying its independent theater chains. As a result of these forays and its own internal mismanagement, UFA stood on the brink of bankruptcy by the end of 1925. It was saved by a $4 million loan offered by two major American studio, famous players Lasky, later Paramount, and Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, in exchange for collaborative rights to UFA studios, theaters, and creative personnel. This arrangement resulted in the founding of Parafamont, later known as Paramount, UFA, and Metro Distribution Company in early 1926, and almost immediate emigration of UFA film artists and technicians to Hollywood, where they worked for a variety of studios. This first Germanic migration was temporary. Many of the filmmakers went back to UFA disgusted at the assembly line character of the American studio system, but many, such as Lubitz, Freund, and Murnau, stayed on to launch full-fledged Hollywood careers, and many more would return during the 1930s to escape Nazi regime. In the meantime, new sensibility that had entered German intellectual life turned away from the morbid psychological themes of expressionism towards an acceptance of life as it is lived phenomenon. Called the new objectivity, this spirit stemmed from the economic dislocations that beset German society in the wake of the war, particularly the impoverishment of the middle classes through raging inflation. In cinema, the grim social realism of the street films of the late 1920s, including G.W. Papp's The Joyless Street 1925, Bruno Rahan's Tragedy of the Streets in 1927, Joy May's Asphalt in 1929, and Pyle Juhl's Berlin Alexanderplatz in 1931, named for the prototype Karl Grundy's Streets, The Streets, in 1923. These films focused on disillusionment, cynicism, and ultimate resignation of the ordinary German people whose lives were crippled during the post-war inflation. The master of the form was G.W. Pabst, whose work established conventions of continuity editing that would become essential to the sound film. In such important realist films as The Love of Jeanne in 1927, Pandora's Box in 1929, and Diary of a Lost Girl in 1929 also, Pabs created complex continuity sequences using techniques that became key features of Hollywood's invisible editing style, such as cutting on action, cutting from a shot of a character's glance to one of what the character sees, motivated point of view shots, and cutting to a reverse angle shot, one in which the camera angles is changed 180 degrees, for example, in a scene which a man and a woman face one another in conversation, the man seen from the woman's point of view and then the woman shown from the man's point of view. Pabst later became an important figure of the early sound period, contributing two significant works in the pacifist films West Front 1918 in 1930 and Comradeship in 1931. Emerging from Germany after the Nazis seized power in 1933, Pabst worked in France and briefly in Hollywood. He returned to Germany in 1941 and made several films for the Nazi-controlled film industry during World War II. By March 1927, UFA was once again facing financial collapse, and it turned this time to the Prussian financier Alfred Hugenberg, a director of the powerful Krupp industrial empire and a leader of the right-wing German National Party who was sympathetic to the Nazis. Hugenberg brought out the American interest in UFA, acquiring a majority of the company's stock and directing the remainder into the hands of his political allies. As chairman of the UFA board, he quietly institutioned a nationalistic production policy that gave increasing prominence to those allies and their cause, and that enabled the Nazis to subvert German film industry when Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933. German cinema then fell under the authority of Joseph Goebbels and his Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda. For the next 12 years, every film made in the Third Reich had to be personally approved for release by Goebbels. Jews were officially banned from the industry, which caused a vast wave of German film artists to leave for Hollywood. Los Angeles became known as the New Weimar, and the German cinema was emptied of the talent and brilliance that had created its golden age. And that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for tuning in.
This is Oroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.